But first up, the science of Thanksgiving dinner. Everything is a science lesson here on The Pulse. And joining us now is Carolyn Beeler. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Maiken.
And you've brought food with you. That's always a good start.
I sure have. I have dinner rolls for us, of course, turkey, and then two slices of pumpkin pie here in the studio.
And what do you want to start with?
The rolls, of course. In my family, we pass those around first thing. And I've often wondered, you know, what gives the dinner roll either its sort of soft, squishy texture in a lot of the store-bought rolls, or the harder, crustier texture like we have here in the studio. And what gives, say, an artisan loaf of bread such a different texture than a pastry dough, a pie dough, when a lot of the ingredients are pretty much the same. So I was looking into it, and the answer is gluten.
Gluten.
Yes, that much maligned protein these days. So I visited a Philadelphia scientist turned baker to explain to me the science behind that gluten.
So my name is Jamie Landers, and I am the owner and baker for Luscious Bakery Food Truck. We are inside the Luscious Bakery Food Truck. It's actually nice and spacious in here.
It smells amazing, too. Landers specializes in brunch fare and was an aerospace engineer for 12 years before opening her bakery this summer. So I thought she was pretty well qualified to show me the science of bread, hands-on.
We are making pumpkin-seeded dinner rolls. So it's a lot like your standard dinner roll. It's going to be lightly crusty on the outside. It's going to have a nice sort of pillowy, airy texture on the inside.
Standing at the large stainless steel counter in her food truck, Landers starts by proofing yeast in warm water and honey.
And now it's got to rest.
And then she measures out the dry ingredients.
So we're going to do about 2¾ cups of bread flour.
Bread flour is a bit different than your typical all-purpose flour.
So the main difference is the protein content.
Landers says choosing the right flour is the first step in giving any baked good the right texture. A flour with more protein creates a chewier dough. A flour with less protein means airier, flakier dough.
So you go from a cake flour
that has 6 to 8% protein to an
all-purpose flour
with 10 to 12% protein
and whole wheat
that has 16% protein. But there's not actual gluten in flour. Gluten is what's called a composite protein made up of glutenin and gliadin. It's when you add water to flour that it coaxes those two wheat proteins together to form gluten.
And they're going to bond. And they're going to create these structures and networks. And these networks create the structure or elasticity of the bread.
So water plus flour makes gluten. But how you treat the dough after adding that water, that's the other key to a baked good's texture. For the pumpkin-seeded dinner rolls, Landers combines the wet ingredients with the dry ingredients and starts to work them together with practiced hands. The mixture starts off wet, then quickly turns into a rough dough, like a really pilly wool sweater, because the gluten bonds haven't started forming yet.
My arm's getting a good workout. Yeah. And you'll notice I've just been kneading for about 90 seconds here, and it already looks different. You can actually see the strands of gluten starting to form.
Landers kneads for about 10 minutes, explaining that she's working out the gluten networks, just like you work out your muscle fibers when you go to the gym.
We're stretching it, but not tearing it. That's going to create, again, a stronger gluten network.
The dough is getting smoother and shinier, the individual strands of gluten becoming less visible. When Landers presses it with her thumb, it bounces back. Now it's ready to rise for an hour. During the rise, the yeast will start to eat the honey and the starches in the dough and then burp out carbon dioxide and alcohol.
Now, because we already formed a gluten network by kneading it for 10 minutes, that's going to create a mesh or a net within it. And it's going to trap that carbon dioxide inside of it. And that's why we're getting that rise.
After another short kneading and dividing the dough into 12 dinner rolls, it's time for another hour-long rise.
All right, off to lunch.
That's just enough time for me to grab lunch and then return back to the food truck.
We're back. Oh my gosh, it smells amazing in here. Okay, are they done? They're ready?
They're ready. They're ready to come out. So they've been fully baked and they're nice and brown and fully risen.
Okay, are you ready?
Yeah.
You guys want to try it?
Yes, please. So I managed not to eat every single one of those rolls while they were hot in the truck, so I brought a couple here for us to try. You want
I'm
one,
I'm glad Lincoln? You did. Of course I do. Oh, wow. They are so good. They have this kind of nice and crusty thing on the outside and then so perfect on the inside.
Yeah, the multiple risings that we did and the kneadings made exactly the texture on the inside that you're talking about, that tender but chewy texture. If we'd been making, say, an artisan loaf, we would have done more kneading and let it rise more times to create even tighter gluten bonds and create an even tougher dough. If we were, say, making a pie dough, we would have touched the dough as little as possible so as not to make too much gluten and used cold butter and cold water to inhibit gluten production.
Where can you find these rolls?
Jamie Lenders bakes for Luscious Bakery. That's a food truck. So you can follow her on Twitter at Luscious Bakery to find out where her food truck is going to be on any given day.
All right. Perfect. And you're going to be back in a little while to talk turkey.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thanks, Megan.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. You may think Thanksgiving is all about the food and the gratitude, but really, it's all about science. We're talking this hour about the science around Thanksgiving dinner, and joining us is Carolyn Beeler. And Carolyn, we have to talk turkey now.
Of course, it's the main event on Thanksgiving. You know, I think it's a lot of people's least favorite food. It's not that exciting. It can often be a little bit dry, but you know, it's not going to be Thanksgiving without a turkey, so you got to have it.
So I've been hearing about people brining their turkey for years now, and I asked you to find out what that actually does to the meat, because I was wondering, is this just one of those foodie things that foodie people do?
No, there's actually a lot of really interesting science behind why brining a turkey actually does keep it tender and juicy, even if you have to cook the breast meat a little bit more than you really should to get the dark meat up to temperature. So I visited a Drexel food scientist to have him explain how brining works.
Yeah, Carol.
Hey, Jake. Nice to meet you.
My name is Jacob Lahn. I'm an assistant professor of food science at Drexel University.
So I actually brought a turkey drumstick and some salt to make a brine in his office, and he was a really good sport about the raw meat that was about 2 feet from his laptop.
Can you tell me, first off, what is the kind of ratio we're looking for a brine here?
In terms of increasing the meat's water-holding capacity, the optimal concentration is right about 1 molar. I worked this out into American measurements for cooking, which works out to be about 2 1/4 teaspoons per cup.
Okay, so that's pretty salty.
Yeah, it's fairly salty.
For an 18 to 20 pound turkey, depending on what kind of container you put it in, you'll need about 7 quarts of water, or 28 cups, and about 1 1/3 cups of salt. Okay, so in Lon's office, we filled our container with water.
I'm going to bet that's around 3 cups.
Okay.
And grind some sea salt into it.
How not to make industrial brine.
Okay, the salt looks dissolved.
Throw in a turkey drumstick.
So I will do this so you don't have to get your hands meaty. All right, so we have turkey drumstick and Tupperware of brine. What is happening right now?
Okay, well, it's happening fairly slowly. You're not seeing anything dramatic happening.
Not dramatic, but surprising. Because at first, if your brine is strong enough, the water actually leaves the meat you're brining and goes into the water because of osmosis.
Osmosis is driven by the concentration of dissolved things on either side of a permeable barrier. And if you have a very high salt concentration on the other side, like if you just rub salt on meat, it will draw moisture out because then you have such a high concentration of solutes and such a low concentration of water.
So when you first dunk that turkey in a strong enough brine, water leaves the turkey, which doesn't have much salt, to go into the brine, which does. And the salt does the reverse. It moves from the brine to the meat.
Once enough salt is taken up into the muscle fibers of the turkey, it causes those muscle fibers at a molecular level to start coming apart a little bit.
The long fibers that make up protein molecules start to unknit, and they want to flap around, basically.
It actually causes the muscle fibers to swell, and that swelling pulls in water because the muscle fibers don't want to have a vacuum. They need to have something to be dissolved in.
And so that causes water to now travel into the turkey, where there are a bunch of turkey proteins that have already disassociated from each other.
When they dissociate from each other because of the salt, they can then associate with more water. And so it's more tender because it's holding more water more tightly. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. So the particles, the turkey particles are breaking apart from each other.
Right.
And then they are bonding then to water molecules, which makes the turkey breaking apart makes it more tender, and then bonding to water makes it more moist.
Yes. That's pretty much right.
And Mike, in most recipes call for brining for about 24 hours.
Carolyn, I'm wondering though, does this make the turkey very salty?
So I never think a brined turkey is too salty. Some people do. But one thing that's for certain is that the drippings are too salty to make a good gravy out of. So Lon, who's a turkey briner himself, recommends making a stock out of the giblets, adding some other vegetables, and then reducing that down to make your gravy.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. And you're going to be back
I will, for dessert.
Excellent. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We're taking a scientific approach to Thanksgiving dinner today with Carolyn Beeler. And Carolyn, you have finally brought dessert, pumpkin pie. I'm going to have a bite right now.
Good. Delicious.
So what are we going to talk about with this pumpkin pie?
Tryptophan.
Why? I mean, it's not in the pie, right?
Right. It's in turkey. It's one of 20 amino acids that form the building blocks of protein. And it's a lot of people's explanation for why they get sleepy after Thanksgiving dinner.
All right. I'm feeling a little sleepy already just hearing the word tryptophan and turkey. But what's with the pumpkin pie?
So I know tryptophan has kind of been talked about to death, but there's actually a really interesting interaction between turkey and the pumpkin pie we just ate. So just hear me out on this one.
All right. Go for it.
Okay, so a lot of people say that if you eat turkey, tryptophan levels in your blood go up, and then they go up in your brain, and tryptophan in the brain creates serotonin, which makes you sleepy. But actually, this is all just a myth. Here's the thing. Turkey has roughly the same amount of tryptophan as any other protein, like chicken or a hamburger or whatever. So there's nothing special about Thanksgiving on that front. The other problems with this myth are a little bit more complicated, so I called up an MIT sleep expert to explain them to me.
Well, I'm Richard Wortman. I'm a professor emeritus now for a couple of years at MIT.
Wortman researches insomnia, among other things. He says the beginning part of the tryptophan and turkey myth is true. You eat turkey, it's broken down in the stomach and intestines and then absorbed.
So blood tryptophan levels go up after you eat turkey protein. The problem is when you eat the protein, you're not just increasing tryptophan, you're also increasing blood levels of half a dozen other amino acids, which compete with tryptophan for getting into the brain.
Wortman pronounces it tryptophan. Other people pronounce it tryptophan. They're both correct. But anyway, whatever you call it, it's actually the rarest amino acid. So when it tries to cross the blood-brain barrier, it has a lot of competition. Wortman says it's like a bunch of people trying to push their way onto the same train at the Tokyo subway.
The door's open. Maybe you have 10 or 15 people trying to get in, and they're competing. They're fighting with each other. They're not all going to make it. And some of them are labeled tryptophan, and more of them are not. So the more others you have competing, the fewer of the tryptophan are going to get in, okay?
So if you eat more protein, more of both the tryptophan people and the other people will just crush around the doors, increasing the gridlock.
Okay, I get all that, but why did you bring in pumpkin pie to talk about all this?
So this is exactly where the pumpkin pie comes in. Pumpkin pie is a carbohydrate, so it increases the secretion of the hormone insulin. And insulin encourages most amino acids to be absorbed by the body.
It lowers the blood levels of these amino acids by increasing their uptake into tissues. But insulin doesn't lower blood levels of tryptophan.
So back to that Tokyo subway analogy, the insulin from the pumpkin pie acts kind of like a bouncer, clearing all the competition off the platform and leaving just the people labeled tryptophan standing.
If you have a carbohydrate, the number of tryptophan people, that's not going to change because there isn't any tryptophan in carbohydrates. But the numbers of competing people, the numbers of other people fighting to get on the subway are going to go down.
So the more tryptophan get on the subway and the subway transports them into the brain.
That's right. And then some cells in the brain use the tryptophan to make serotonin, and more gets released. And that's why carbohydrates make a lot of people sleepy, but not turkey. It doesn't do it.
So, Carolyn, if I skip the pumpkin pie, does that mean I'll be less sleepy after eating lots of turkey?
So if you reduce your carbohydrate intake, it is possible that you might reduce that crossing of tryptophan from the blood-brain barrier. The thing is, there's always tryptophan in the blood. We're always kind of eating carbohydrates. So the sleepiness after Thanksgiving dinner is probably more to do with the fact that you sit down and eat a lot. So your blood is traveling to your digestive system to help you digest rather than going up to your brain or your muscles to make you nice and active. Plus, you might have had a couple glasses of wine after that big meal and you're all lounging around watching football. So there's a lot of other factors at play here.
So blame the 5,000 calories, not the turkey.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thanks, Megan.